So hello, everyone. I'm Dr. Trish Murray, physician, best-selling author, and the Health Catalyst speaker. And you're listening to Discover Health Podcast. And today, the title of our podcast is Optimizing the Life of Seniors. And I am so excited to have a colleague that's been such a wonderful, you know, person in our local community here of the Mount Washington Valley. Marian Jackson, who was a medical doctor here for many years, and now she's very busy doing some other things past retirement. So Marian, thank you so much for coming on the show.
It's a treat. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Oh, absolutely. So folks, Marian's lived an amazing life. I'm going to read this bio that she has provided to us to just give you a glimpse of what she's been involved in. So Marian Jackson served the New Hampshire North Country as an obstetrics and gynecologist for 25 years before leaving to complete a master's degree in public health at the University of North Carolina. There, she worked in patient safety and quality until happily returning to the Mount Washington Valley in January of 2015. Now retired and living in Madison, New Hampshire, she is devoting much of her energy toward being the vice president of the board of the Gibson Center. In this role, she co-coordinated the 11-town Mount Washington Valley Age-Friendly Community Initiative and has launched HomeShare MWV Gibson, which is an effort to pair homeowners with safe and compatible renters in their homes. She is also dedicated to making conversations about end-of-life decision-making a natural and comfortable topic for families. In that capacity, she serves on the End of Life Healthcare Decisions Coalition, which is part of the Foundation for Healthy Communities in Concord. She is a member of two task forces of the Governor's Commission on Aging. For fun, Marian sits on the Tin Mountain Energy team that promotes renewable energy and reduction of energy waste. Her recent awards include the Joseph A. Vaughn Award given by the governor to a person from each county in recognition of exemplary volunteer efforts on behalf of the New Hampshire's older adults. The MWV Age-Friendly Community Action Plan that she drafted with the other Gibson Center leaders won the New Hampshire Plan of the Year Award in May, and most recently it won the Northern New England Planners Association Award for Plan of the Year. Last spring, she was awarded the Tin Mountain Conservation Center Distinguished Service Award for her efforts on behalf of renewable and clean energy efficiency. Wow, I hope, Marian, I'm still going as strong as you are. So when I retire, so.
Eclectic.
So Marian, the first question I love to ask every single guest, because I think it's so insightful and opening for people to hear, is how have you come to be of service the way you are presently?
I come by it by birth. My mother she only died 2 years ago at 99, and she was a woman of exceptional character and service of that greatest generation that are the women who volunteered, who made communities function during all those years of the 50s when, let's just say, had she been born when I was, she would have been the president of a bank, or she would have been the senator from Massachusetts. She would have been, she was a remarkable woman. And so the idea of serving the community, being a person who is a leader and who brings people together was what I just grew up with that in my family as what you do. And then I was very, very lucky as a high school student to be asked to be work for an internist in town. I was 14 years old, but the nurses in that office treated me like I actually knew something and I could take care of my part of the responsibilities in the office, which then led to a career that took me to nursing school, which then led to physical therapy school, and I graduated with an MS in physical therapy, but then went directly into medicine from there. Have never looked back, have been thrilled, very, very pleased with what my career path. It sometimes was extremely hard. And in some ways, I think, as you know, being in rural medicine has a little bit of a missionary sort of feel to it because you're so alone and isolated, but at the same time, totally supported by your community. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't trade it for anything. So that's why when I say happily moved back to the Mount Washington Valley, it's because this is where it happens. This is where we make a difference. And it's been really fulfilling.
Yeah.
Does that answer your question?
Oh, yeah, it's wonderful. That's why I always ask it. It's so amazing to hear everyone's story of how they've come to where they are. So a question I have to ask, though, before we move on is, how did you go from PT to OB-GYN?
In a circuitous kind of way, but I recognized when I was in physical therapy that there was more I could learn, more I really wanted to know. And quite honestly, I was at that cusp in the lives of women that I began to, it was only after I had been through the physical therapy school that I realized I could, as a woman, be accepted and go on to medical school, because mm-hmm. having grown up in the 50s, that would not have been something that would have been an option.
Right.
It was then in medical school that I became that much more aware of what we do in OBGYN and the role I could play in the lives of women. And I cared deeply about women's reproductive health. Mm-hmm. And I was either going to go the route I did or go to the CDC and work internationally in reproductive health. So I don't know what that life would have been. I did this one. So,
I can tell you that the Mount Washington Valley is very glad you made the choice you did, because I know that you know, you've retired. I'm still in practice, but I can tell you when I first came to this community, it was like, if you needed to see an OB-GYN, you wanted to see you.
Thank
Dr.
you.
Marian Jackson.
Thank you. So, well, it's because I really enjoyed the work together in partnership with the patients whose lives I always wanted to just see them reach their greatest potential. That was my mantra.
And exactly as you've said, they know that and they feel it. And that's what they give back to us is the love of and that connection of the relationship of, you know, getting each other and working together to optimize
right.
someone's health. So right. that's so awesome. So let's get into talking about how we optimize the life of seniors.
Okay.
So first of all, what is an AARP age-friendly community, and how does it have an impact on the lives of older folks?
Wonderful. AARP is an affiliate, if you will, of the World Health Organization's age-friendly initiative, which looked, starting in about 2005, looked at the world and said, our demographics are that we are aging, and we have the opportunity to look at our communities internationally, all across the world, at what are the domains of health in our communities that create the best life for seniors. And AARP then developed a model for examining our communities using what they use and the World Health Organization uses 8 domains. How do I find my 8 fingers? And we, in our work, boiled it down to 5, but it's a way of bringing together the municipal leaders in towns and cities with the nonprofits and other agencies who also work on issues related to aging, partner with them, cooperate, collaborate, all those wonderful C words that bring us to joining forces to look through the lens of aging to make our communities stronger. And that's not at a sacrifice of other generations, because when you start to really examine it, what's good for seniors is good for toddlers, is good for young families. So let me just say that our local effort brought our work focused on five domains, which are health, housing, transportation, outdoor spaces, meaning recreation and parks and roads and streets, and community connections. And that when you look at those domains and find all the people in your region who are working in those areas and begin to connect them to each other, the possible benefits, the projects, the collaborative efforts just multiply rapidly, because all of these people are mission driven and have the same big goals in mind. But what the age-friendly community initiative does is brings them together, convened in a way that they're really talking to each other and say, and what we see are people who then will hear from one agency of what they're trying to do. And the other says, oh, we've got some of those. Why don't we partner with you on that? Or one town has got a terrific outreach program for transportation. And the next town says, we've been trying to crack that nut. Can we borrow what you've done? Mm-hmm. Of course. So you learn from each other, you borrow, you steal ideas from each other. Yeah. And you can obviously see that many things then can start to happen.
Absolutely. I mean, collaboration and interaction is so beneficial. I mean, we've had a health collaborative in the Valley before, and I've sat on that committee, and the same thing was happening. You know, one agency or office would talk to another, and exactly what you described. The more people come together and talk about what the needs are and what's happening and what one's doing, and the other one says, oh, well, we have stuff that could help you, and you have things that can help us, so let's get together and
join forces.
The ages of competition are gone, and the idea of let's collaborate and come together is such a beneficial thing, because we all benefit.
Let me give you a very quick example that I think demonstrates it. Because we are now well known for having come together, we obtained a grant from the Tufts Health Momentum Fund to, quote, equip, train, and connect seniors to the internet. And what we have are donated computers from all over the place, the Waldorf School, the Northway Bank, individuals. And those computers are getting refurbished and cleaned up. They are being donated to seniors who need laptops and desktops. We have, and that donation came through the Conway Library, which is also providing a tutor who will train seniors on how to use internet capability for things like just simple email, Zoom conferences, telehealth. We are partnering with the Gibson Center, the library, the visiting nurses to identify who are the people who would benefit from that training, and a couple other local business people who are donating their time to do the tutoring and the computer refurbishing. That's what can happen when you bring all these different people together, because the Gibson Center, the Conway Library couldn't do it alone.
Right.
But with everybody saying, well, I can contribute some of that, it's like stone soup. Everybody brings a little piece of it together, and it makes it possible to train 25 to 50 seniors in how to be on the internet.
Which is amazing during this time, of course, of the COVID-19, now 20 pandemic, in the essence of, wow, so many people of every generation, but particularly seniors, if they don't have the technical skills that, because of course, you know, the way we connect now is so much more online like this, you and I are on Zoom. So What has the COVID pandemic highlighted also about the health and well-being of our seniors, besides this one example you've already pointed out?
COVID obviously has devastated the senior, most senior community disproportionately more than younger people. One of the things it has pointed out and has made worse is ageism, which is a way of stigmatizing elders and making them feel disposable, dispensable, as if their contribution or lives are less important than someone else. It has pointed out our one more reason why trying to maximize aging at home, aging in place, is so much more meaningful and purposeful and safe. So there's that. We had already been working hard to try to help more and more people age in place. And now we understand how much more important having everything in place to help that, whether that's more caregivers, more home health aides, paying our health, whether it's nursing assistants or MAs, the people who make that possible for the most elder seniors. So COVID has created more divides in the way it has anyway. There's digital divides, there are income divisions, there are racial divisions that COVID has highlighted in the most horrible way. But seniors are suffering from that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so many of our clients, I mean, we've done live movement programs, and I've also done a community before where people come together in the evening and we even share meals and things like that. So it's so difficult when you can't do those things, especially for the folks and even the podcasts and the webinars I do. For a long time, people would come if they couldn't do the technology piece or they didn't have the technology piece, they would come to our office and they would listen from the other room and we'd set it all up for them. And we have done some of that still where people just wear masks. But my point is that, you know, for those that aren't technically, as you brought up earlier, trained and aren't, you know, they need that training, that program you alluded to is fantastic. And they can still stay in contact. But COVID has definitely caused such a difficult time for so many people. And especially, as you say, the seniors and their health and their overall well-being, which also has brought up more knowledge of loneliness or separation and what it can do for our overall health. So what does the research tell us about, you know, loneliness and separation on seniors and overall health and wellness?
The research existed before COVID. COVID has provided us, unfortunately, there will be many more PhDs written based on information that will come out of this this year and a half, whatever it turns out to be. The research is stunning in its conclusions that loneliness, and let me back up, maybe some of your listeners are aware of the initiatives in Great Britain to combat loneliness, because they have determined it is one of the most significant risk factors for death. So anyone who really wants to dive into this, I want to encourage you to look at some of the literature coming out of Great Britain and why is it that they have said this is one of our number one health risks and we're going after it. But in a broad brush, loneliness and isolation increase some of the obvious things, depression, suicide, but also diminish appetite, so thereby nutrition suffers. Inflammatory diseases then are thereby increased. And I shouldn't say thereby, I don't know that we know, maybe you know much better the data on how these things interact, but the correlation is undeniable.
Well, go
ahead.
And there is some research that shows that people that are dealing with loneliness on a regular basis have a higher CRP or HSCRP, either of those markers, are right. a marker of generalized inflammation. And they have been shown to have higher levels of these two particular inflammation markers. And in the functional medicine world, we know that inflammation is such a brewer's yeast, if you will, of causing chronic disease. That if we have increased inflammation, we're going to develop more and more chronic diseases, such as high blood pressure or heart disease or lung disease or other diseases of the systems of the body, because the body is chronically inflamed. So yeah, that research does exist in that marker.
Thank you for that. This is, for your listeners, we're now really having a conversation. This is informing me of the specific markers, and that it just, as you're suggesting, it worsens some of the dementias that are also already at in play because of the isolation. You now have a lack of stimulation. You have an increase in anxiety, which is leading to increased sleep disorder or disrupted sleep. Mm-hmm. So this cascade of inflammatory markers, the mental health disorders, as well as the physical disorders. If someone's arthritis gets worse and they are now isolated and unable to get out and walk and move because their usual companions can't come over and get folks out to walk, the normal things that you do, there's a lot of suffering. And I know that our folks who have been working at the Adult Day Center have seen a marked decline in the functionality of many of their clients who had to be turned away as the Adult Day Center closed, despite their working very hard to stay in touch by phone and Zoom when they can. There's just nothing to be, you can't underestimate the power of voice and touch and, you know, the nuance of a smile and those sorts of interactions.
Absolutely.
And really seeing people go downhill.
Yeah, and particularly even between generations, meaning there's research that has been done in nursing homes or senior homes, let's say, where they bring in children to interact right. with the older folks, the seniors. And the seniors' cognition gets better, their ability to move improves, their depression and anxiety get better. So the fact that you, again, combat loneliness by bringing not only people of the same generation together, but particularly if you bring people of different generations together, particularly the young and the old. It's so amazing because, of course, it makes us all smile to interact with little ones on a regular basis. So that
I want your listeners to know about a program that's been replicated, and there are some others that are similar, called Music and Memory. I don't know if you're familiar, but it's a beautiful mechanism by which certainly the professional care providers in a nursing home, but even more wonderfully is when teenagers come in, interview the senior about their music preferences and put a playlist together that has all that wonderful Gershwin or Sinatra or jazz, or, you know, what did you play at your wedding? What did you listen to when, blah, blah, and puts that together. So there's the interview, there's the playing the music together, and then the elder has that playlist back either at home or whenever they want to listen to it. Music, choirs, singing, dance, we know that all of these arts are stimulating very important parts of the brain, as well. And those, we can get down to hormones and oxytocin and prolactin and all these things, but they're engendered by those multi-generational relationships and then the arts. So these are things that we look forward to being able to get back to on a person-to-person basis when the COVID is over, or we've got it under control. But we're really looking hard at ways to do the best we can, whether that's Zoom, FaceTime, getting kids and these elders together.
Right. Yeah, and it's so important. I mean, it's just amazing the different things that it sounds like you're working on and trying to help people with. It's amazing. Now, didn't also the Conway from the AARP get some sort of recognition as far as our area?
Well,
and your plan?
The plan did. This was so outrageous because I'm not a city planner. I'm a doctor, you know. So we followed the roadmap that AARP puts together, yeah. and we did it a little more creatively, and we did say, we are not one town. We're a region. We're the Mount Washington Valley, with one regional high school, one regional hospital, regional newspaper, chamber of commerce, etc. And we're much better when we all band together, just the way we started the show. So we are unique amongst the AARP community, age-friendly communities, that we have this regional approach, but we include Freiburg for a good reason, but now we're two states. So Freiburg, Maine has joined with the Mount Washington Valley of New Hampshire, and it meant that we have resources from both the Maine AARP and New Hampshire. So we have wonderful coaches and mentors in both states helping us. So
that's awesome.
But one of the real huge benefits with this AARP network is their networks of webinars and calls for us, particularly with what's called the Rural Health Collaborative. So we are on phone calls with people in Idaho and Iowa and Texas, with people who are also rural, who have the same issues, trying to figure out how do we deal with the transportation issues of people who are 50 miles from, you know, the nearest whatever, or, you know, who don't have close family units or public transportation. So it's real. We feel very lucky to be connected to people who are looking at housing and transportation and community connections in many, many different ways and solving the problems.
And again, it gets back to the beginning of the collaboration and the idea that we don't just collaborate with people here in our own community, because our community has its own paradigms and its own history and what we've always focused on. But if you start talking to someone, like you say, from Idaho or Texas or somewhere else, it's like, well, maybe their paradigm's different and they get us to look at things differently. And and we do the same for them. So that's amazing. So Marian, let's talk about end of life care planning, because of course, none of us get out alive and we're aging.
That's right.
And if you want to optimize your senior life, one of the things you don't want to avoid is the fact that none of us get out alive. And it's probably, it's very helpful to not focus on it, but at least have the conversations so your family knows what you want or what you don't want and things like that. So what is important for seniors to know about end of life care planning, and why is this topic so difficult when it relieves so much anxiety if you do open the door and start having the conversation?
Oh, thanks for this chance to talk about this. It's such a great topic. I think to answer the second question first, one of the reasons it's so hard is that our options and the choices have changed so dramatically over the last 20 years that we don't have the model of our parents having had any discussions at all. Because if you look at lifespan and you look at what did people die of before about the 1950s, it was diseases and conditions that caused rapid death. If you look at in the early 1900s, the average length of time between when the onset of symptoms and death was 14 days. Days. Now we live with chronic illness for years and years, and we have many, many, many more interventions and choices that were not available. So my mother never would have had a conversation with her parents about end of life decision making. There was nothing to decide because it just happened. My mother, fortunately, was so progressive. The reason I care about and I've been in this is that she started filling out her advanced directives back in the late 1970s, early 80s, revised them over the decades and sent them out to all of us. And it meant that as our four siblings, we knew who she was, what she wanted, what she didn't want. And we did not have to question it, and we didn't have any arguments amongst each other about what to do about mom, because we knew very clearly. And what I want everyone to understand about what is important is taking the opportunity to have the control over expressing your values to the generations, so that there doesn't have to be the kind of angst, guilt, confusion, conflict at a time when families are already suffering because somebody's ill, that those do not need to be compounded by a lack of knowing, when we can early on have facilitated conversations. There are many professionals trained to help people understand what filling out an advance directive can mean, but to a person, when they have completed the conversations, they all look at each other going, wow, wasn't that the best? Wow, to think we weren't going to have this conversation, because we learn about each other, about what matters, what we have striven for, what we want people to remember us for. It's a relief to families. So I want people to know that they can go to the websites to download in their state advanced directives. They don't need a lawyer. They don't need any other, you know, heavy duty help unless they want it. And then most medical offices have people who can counsel them through the language of an advanced directive. It needs to be something that everybody in the family knows that it exists, and there are copies dispensed everywhere. And that, and I've even gotten to where I travel with mine, because as it has happened, my most serious medical issues have been when I was traveling, and lo and behold, you know, I'm in some other state and they say, do you have an advance directive? Yeah, now I have it in my suitcase. Such a gift. It is a way of having, we like in our generation to have control. We've always wanted control. And if you ask people, that is what they want more than anything else. And so to take the time to say, I want everything done. I want to live as long as I possibly can. That's your choice, if you make it clear. If your choice is, at this time in my life, if I can't return to XYZ function, then I don't want to keep living, because that isn't living to me. And I want my family to understand what that means, what's that look like, and let them, without guilt, say no, let her have a natural death. And as an aside, do not resuscitate is actually allow natural death. Let's look at the language. Allow natural death is a kind way of saying, I got to go somehow. And my mother used to say, do not take my ticket out of here. I have some tickets, and they may be that heart attack, and do not take my ticket. She did not want to live as a person with major disabilities, and she didn't. But I think, you know, that's, it's people have the choice. And the most important thing is to exercise that choice. And don't leave it to the medical community that otherwise doesn't know. And it's not fair to them.
Right.
And it's not fair to the families. So I really want people to approach it. I wish it was something that we talked about openly, readily, really comfortably with each other.
I would totally, you know, applaud and echo everything you said. My personal experience with my folks was not as wonderful, and your mom living as long as she did. My mom ended up with Alzheimer's for many, many years. Mm. And but I did open the conversation with my father, of course, around, well, what do you think mom would want? And then I've had, obviously, prior to my dad's passing, had the open conversation with him. So it's, I totally understand the idea of opening that door and having that conversation. Being in the medical field, though, I'm comfortable with that because I've had those conversations with many families along the way in my training and so forth. So for us, we sort of do it because it's something we do on a regular basis with the patients we work with. But folks out there, I would reiterate, open the door and have the conversation. It reduces anxiety. It makes you feel closer to your loved one because you respect each other and understand what each other feels and what each other wants. And you may want something different than your parent or vice versa, but have the conversation and have each person have the right to make their own decision about end of life thoughts and what their options are. So thank you, Marian, so much for coming on the show. It's been great to share and hear your ideas about everything that's going on here in the Mount Washington Valley to help optimize the life of our seniors, and then across, and how you're collaborating with towns and communities all over the country. That's amazing.
We're having a great time, and I really appreciate being able to talk. If any of your audience has questions about things we've talked about or wants resources, links to things, I'd be more than happy to communicate with them about, you know, where they can turn.
And where can they turn? Like, what's one place you would recommend anyone go to learn more about some of the topics we've talked about today?
You know, and this is not an advertisement, but the AARP website does have significant material. I'm going to get my compassionate caring and caring compassionately mixed up. I will let you know, and your listeners can then get the link from you in terms of where they can download their state-by-state advanced directives.
Okay, we always transcribe these podcasts. So below, we would absolutely put whatever you send to me that people could read below and be able to get that.
And so that's awesome. As a single book, Atul Gawande's Being Mortal is just as outstanding. I've never had anybody who said they didn't get something wonderful out of it. So,
awesome. So that's Being Mortal. That's
Being great. Mortal. Yeah.
That's great. So Marian, I always love to end with asking again, every single guest, and I can't wait to hear your answer, is what is your number one secret for living a healthy life?
Balance, a little bit of everything, a lot of different things, and whether that's music and play and absolutely exercise, reading. I read everything eclectically, and my staying socially connected. I just, obviously I thrive on that. I couldn't do without any one of those elements.
Yeah, and it's so important to balance them all. We all, like right now in my life, business is so busy that it's starting to lose a little balance. And it's like, wait a minute, what can I pull back so that I maintain my balance of my personal life and my business life, for example? But we all do that, and we get off balance. We all get off balance. We fall off the wagon, this and that. But that's what we may want to do once a month, let's say, is look in the mirror and ask yourself, what's out of balance and what needs to come back into balance for each of you in the idea of trying to keep yourself as optimally happy and in balance as you possibly can. So Marianne, thank you.
It's not a perfect day every day, but you worked, you get it over the course of the month and the year. The balance is there.
Yeah, and that's what we work for. And the idea of once you start focusing on it and looking at it, then you are in control. Just like the end of life decisions, you get to be in control of maintaining your balance.
Great.
So thank you so much for coming on the show, Marianne. And everybody, make sure you check out the AARP, as well as we'll put the other link, and Being Mortal, check out that book. So thanks so much for listening to the show. Thanks so much for being on the show, Marianne. And we'll see you on the next episode of Discover Health.